Chapter 37. Ali Ghami glanced at his watch for about the dozenth time since Gaddafi had started speaking, and he kept looking over at an assistant who hovered near the front door, a radio bud in his ear. Every time he met the man's eyes, the aide would shake his head imperceptibly. Charles Moon's bodyguard had pointed out the behavior to him, and as he studied the Libyan minister more closely, he saw other signs of his disquiet. Ghami was constantly shifting from foot to foot, or thrusting his hands into his jacket pocket only to remove them an instant later. Many guests were growing tired of the long speech, which was now closing in on a half hour, but Ghami seemed more agitated than bored. He looked again at his aide. The suited man was turned slightly away, his hand to his ear to listen better over Gaddafi's droning voice. He turned back a moment later and nodded at Ghami. A smile of triumph spread across his face. "Showtime," Moon's guard said nonchalantly. Ghami climbed one of the steps to get the Libyan president's attention. When Gaddafi cut off his rambling praises of Fiona Katamora, the minister climbed higher and whispered into his ear. Gaddafi visibly paled. "Ladies and gentlemen," he said, his voice, which had been so compassionate and clear moments earlier, quavering, "I have just been given the worst news possible." Moon translated for his companion's sake. "It appears that the beloved American Secretary of State managed to survive the horrific airplane crash." This was met with a collective gasp, and conversations sprang up spontaneously all around the room. "Please, ladies and gentlemen, your attention, please. This is not what it seems. Following the crash, she was abducted by forces loyal to Suleiman al-Jamaa. I have just been given word that they are about to carry out her execution. Minister Ghami also tells me they have a way of communicating with us in this house." Gaddafi followed his foreign minister into the next room, and soon many of the more sang-froid of the guests were crammed into every corner. The guard had Moon hold back so they were still in the entry hall, peering over the shoulders of others. The television had been turned on, its pale glow making the people look like the blood had been drained from their bodies. Several women were crying. An image suddenly sprang up on the monitor. Sitting in front of a black background was Secretary Katamora. Her hair was a tangled mess after her ordeal, and her wide dark eyes were red-rimmed. The gag tied across her mouth pulled her cheeks back in an ugly rictus, but still she looked beautiful. The weeping intensified. A man hiding his features with a checked keffiyeh stepped into view. He carried a sword with a small nick in its blade. "We, the servants of Suleiman al-Jamaa, come before you tonight to rid the world of another infidel," he said. "This is our answer to the Crusaders' efforts to thrust their decadence upon us. From this unholy woman has come the worst of their lies, and for that, she must die." Moon's guard watched Ghami's reaction closely. Something about what was playing out on the television had him off kilter. Gaddafi picked up the small camera from the television stand and held it at arm's length. "My brother," he said, "my Muslim brother who basks in the light of Allah, peace be upon him. This is no longer the way. Peace is the natural order of the world. Bloodshed only begets bloodshed. Can you not see that taking her life will accomplish nothing? It will not end the suffering in the Muslim world. Only discourse can do that. Only when we sit facing our enemies and discussing what brought us to such a state can we ever hope to live in harmony. The Quran tells us there can be no harmony with the infidel. The Quran also tells us to love all life. Allah has given us this contradiction as a choice for each man to make. The time for choosing hatred is over. Our governments are meeting now so we make this same choice for all our people. I beg you to lay down your sword. Spare her life." No one could see the swordsman's features because of the headscarf, but his body language was easy enough to read. His shoulders slumped, and he let the heavy scimitar fall from view. Then, From the back of the reception hall came the sound of running feet, dozens of them pounding across the marble floor. The plan was falling apart. Ali Ghami yanked the camera from Gaddafi's hand. "Mansour!" he screamed at his bodyguard. "What are you doing? Our gunmen are here. Kill her. Do it now!" Rather than take up his sword again to slice off her head, the figure on the television helped pull the gag from Secretary Katamura's mouth.
"Mansour!"
Ghami cried again.
"No!"
Someone yanked the camera away from the minister at the same time he felt the barrel of a pistol crammed into his spine. He looked over to see an Asian man, Charles Moon's bodyguard, standing behind him. "Game's up, Suleiman," Eddie Sang said. "Take a look." On the monitor, the man Ghami thought was his most trusted confidant pulled the keffiyeh from around his head. "How'd it go?" Chairman Cabrillo asked, half his head swaddled in bandages. "I think the term is red-handed." The squad of President Gaddafi's personal bodyguards came to a halt in the entrance to report that they had overwhelmed the security personnel outside without needing to fire a shot. Gaddafi, who'd been briefed on the operation by Charles Moon earlier in the afternoon, rounded on his minister.
"The charade is over.
After receiving an anonymous tip this afternoon, members of the Swiss military raided the house where you've been holding my grandson after faking his death in an automobile accident. He is safe, so you can no longer sit like an asp at my breast, threatening to strike if I don't allow you free rein."
"I truly did not know you were Al-Jama. I thought you blackmailed me to attain your current position for selfish gains of power. But now you have exposed yourself to the world. Your guilt is without question, and your execution will be swift. And I will work tirelessly to rid my government of anyone who even spoke of you highly."
Gaddafi spread his arms to encompass the important people in the room. "We stand united in rejecting your ways, and the failure of your plot to kill leaders from other Muslim nations will serve as notice to others who stand in the way of peace. Take this piece of garbage from my sight." A burly Libyan soldier grabbed Ghami by the scruff of the neck and frog-marched him through the stunned crowd. From the television came a woman's voice.
"Mr. President, I couldn't have said that better myself."
Fiona Katamura was standing at Juan's side.
"And I want to assure all the conference's attendees that I will be at the bargaining table tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock sharp, so together we can all usher in a new era."
The bullet that grazed the chairman's head in the frigate's mess had knocked him out for only a second, while the single round he'd managed to fire had done something far more remarkable. It had hit the sword as it swung, throwing off the executioner's aim. The blade had struck the metal back of the chair, knocking it sideways and tumbling Fiona to the deck. Lying on the floor, Juan triggered off a pair of three-round bursts, killing the cameraman and his assistant. The swordsman had lost his weapon, and he backed away from Fiona, holding his hands over his head.
"Please," he begged. "I am unarmed."
"Uncuff her," Juan ordered, "and remove her gag." Before he could comply, the man who'd been threatening her life moments ago wet himself. "It's a little tougher facing armed men in combat than blowing up innocents, huh?" Juan mocked. When the gag came off, he asked the secretary, "Are you okay?"
"Yes, I think so. Who are you?"
"Let's just say I'm the spirit of Lieutenant Henry Lafayette and leave it at that." Juan pulled the hand radio from his pants pocket.
"Max, do you copy?"
"About damn time you called in," Max said so gruffly that Cabrillo knew he was beside himself with concern.
"I've got her, and we're on our way out."
"Make it quick. The SIDRA is accelerating, and we've only got about 2 minutes for your extraction plan to work." Fiona got to her feet, massaging her wrists where the cuffs had dug into her skin. She kept a wary distance from the swordsman, but did the most astonishing thing Juan could imagine. She said,
"I forgive you, and someday I pray you will come to see me not as your enemy, but as your friend. She turned to Juan. Do not kill this man.
Cabrillo was incredulous.
With all due respect, are you nuts?
Without a backward glance, she strode from the room. Juan, made to follow, turned back on the swordsman and fired a single shot. He grabbed the script from the deck where it had fallen and noted the frequency the television camera was going to broadcast on, the final piece of his plan. When he caught up to where he said, I couldn't have him follow us, so I put one through his knee. He took her hand, and together they raced for the main deck. The smoke, he noticed, was much thinner. A pair of sailors was on the top landing of the stairs. They didn't react until they recognized the Japanese-American Secretary of State. As if choreographed, they jumped at her simultaneously. Juan shot one as he flew, and the bullet's impact was enough to alter his trajectory. The second slammed into Juan's chest with enough force to blow the air from his lungs. Choking to refill them, Juan was defenseless for several moments, an opening the sailor took to throw a quick series of punches. Fiona tried to wrestle him off her rescuer, and had she not been through the ordeal of the past few days, she would have succeeded, but she was exhausted beyond her body's limit. The sailor shoved her aside contemptuously and threw a kick that caught Cabrillo on the chin. From outside the confines of the ship came a roar that rattled the stairwell. A missile had streaked off a hidden launch tube buried on the Oregon's deck. It lifted into the growing darkness on a fiery column that seemed to split the sky. The explosive-tipped rocket began to topple almost immediately on its short projected flight. The sound galvanized the chairman, and he found a berserker's fury. The kick had rattled his brain, so he fought on instinct alone. He ducked as the next blow came at him and smashed his elbow down on the sailor's exposed shin with enough force to snap the bone. The man screamed when he put weight on it, and the shattered ends grated against one another. Juan gained his feet, rammed a knee into the sailor's groin, and pushed him down the rest of the steps. He grabbed Fiona's hand, and they rushed for the exit. The hatch he had used to gain entry into the Sidra's superstructure was closed, and when he opened it, expecting to see the Oregon hard against the frigate's side, he saw instead that his ship was a good 30 feet away. In her wake, the rocket's contrail hung in the air, a twisting snake that corkscrewed into the night. From the far side of the frigate came an explosion much more powerful than anything felt since the battle had begun. The ship-to-shore rocket had impacted on the inside of the main sluice gates for the Zanzer Bay Tidal Power Station. 8 assault rifles poured their deadly fire into the mouth of the side cave. Stone chips and ricochets filled the air like a swarm of angry hornets. All 4 Americans were bleeding from multiple hits, though no one had as serious an injury as Eric Stone's shoulder. There was so much coming in at them that there was no way they could return fire, so they hunkered near the entrance as the terrorists advanced behind a wall of lead. One gunman suddenly burst into the cave, shouting wildly. He fired from the hip, raking the walls, tearing apart the bed, and blowing books off the shelves. Linda hit him with a 3-round burst to the chest before he could aim at any of them, blowing his body back out into the main cavern. It had been dumb luck that she had killed him before he got any of them, and she knew that wouldn't happen again. Next time, the entire team would rush them, and it would be over. Linda checked her ammo. She had no spare magazines in her harness, and the clip jammed into her rifle's receiver was only half full. Eric was out of rounds and held his weapon like a club, ready to defend himself hand to hand. Mark Murphy couldn't have very many bullets left either, she knew. A lifetime of defending her country had come down to this last stand in a dark cave far from home, fighting a bunch of fanatics who wanted nothing more than the right to keep on killing. The firing outside the cave slackened slightly. They were preparing for the final push. A grenade flew out of the smoke-filled passage and landed in the alcove loaded with chests. The wood absorbed half of the blast, belching splinters and glittering gold coins while the spray of shrapnel peppered the cave walls. Again, no one had been hit, but the concussion left them reeling. Bits of burning wood had landed on the beds and caught the linens on fire.
In seconds, the air was choked with smoke. Eric screamed something to Linda, but she couldn't hear him with her ringing ears. They would come now, she was certain. In the wake of the grenade's detonation, the terrorists had to know they had them. Filthy, aching, emotionally raw, she tightened her finger around the Rec 7's trigger. But nothing happened for long seconds. Of the 7 surviving terrorists, only one or two were firing into the cave now. They were waiting us out, Linda thought, knowing the smoke will force us to them, or hoping we'd die in the fire. Lying prone to get out of the worst of it, Linda took tiny sips of the fouled air, but each breath seared her lungs. Assad's men were going to get their wish, she thought grimly. They couldn't stay here much longer. She looked over at Eric and Mark, her eyes questioning. They seemed to read her mind, and both nodded their assent. Linda scrambled to her knees and launched herself onto her feet, her shipmates at her side. "Let's go, Sundance!" Mark shouted as they charged into the mouths of the waiting guns. They sprinted past the burning drapery over the cave's entrance and made a good 5 feet, and still hadn't drawn fire. Linda searched for a target in the wavering light of the ship burning in the distance, but spotted no one standing to face them. There was a terrorist sprawled on the ground a few paces from her, a neatly drilled hole between his shoulder blades. Then she saw others they had somehow managed to hit. The cavern floor was littered with them. Her headlong rush slackened until she stood stock still with a total of 8 bodies at her feet. She felt a superstitious tingle run the length of her spine. One of the men moved weakly, clawing at the sand and gasping for air. Like the first, he'd been hit in the back. Mark kicked the AK out of the man's reach and rolled him over. Frothy blood from his ruptured lung bubbled from his lips. Linda had never seen Tariq Assad, so she didn't recognize his distinctive unibrow.
"Ho!"
he gasped.
"Your guess is as good as ours, pal," Mark told him.
And then over the crackling of the burning soccer and through the ringing in their ears came a rich, melodious baritone singing, "From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, we will fight our country's battles in the air, on land, and sea."
"Link?"
Linda cried. "How you doing, sweet stuff?" He emerged from his cover position with his rifle cocked on his hip and a pair of night vision goggles pulled down around his neck. "Got here as fast as I could, but this bod wasn't made for running across the damn desert." Linda threw her arms around the big man, sobbing into his chest. The depth of determination to face her enemies in a suicidal charge dissolving into profound relief at being alive. Mark and Eric pounded his back, laughing and choking on the smoke at the same time.
"Looks like you guys made a good show for yourselves," which from Link was his greatest sign of respect.
Alana staggered from the cave, her torso bare and once white bra blackened with soot. She was holding a couple of books as gingerly as she could. Their pages smoldered. When one started burning, Mark took it from her, dropped it on the ground, and kicked sand over it to snuff the flames.
"I wanted to save more," she managed between coughs. "But the smoke, I couldn't. I did get this, though."
"What's that?" Link asked.
Dangling from a crudely fashioned chain of silver was a small crystal nestled in a rudimentary setting. The piece of jewelry wasn't particularly attractive. In fact, it looked almost like a child's attempt at making a Mother's Day present out of pipe cleaners and paste. But there was something compelling about it beyond its obvious antiquity, an aura as if it were a presence there in the cave with them. A bullet had shattered the stone, so it lay in its cradle in tiny shards no bigger than grains of sugar, and from it oozed a single claret drop.
"Holy God,"
Mark said, dropping to his knees to scoop up the soaked spot of sand. From a shirt pocket, he pulled out a power bar and ripped away its wrapping. He threw the food aside and carefully placed the tiny bit of mud on the paper and twisted it closed. There was a red streak on his palm that mingled with the blood from a deep cut he'd received at some point during the battle.
"When the covers burned away," Alana explained, I realized there was a mummy on the bed, placed on his side, facing Mecca as a good Muslim should. This was around his neck. Henry Lafayette must have placed Aljama like that when the old man died and left him with his greatest treasure. That is the jewel of Jerusalem, isn't it? And that was his blood, preserved for 2,000 years in a vacuum within that crystal.
His blood? Link asked. Who his?
Stuffed in that candy wrapper in Mark's hands may be the blood of Jesus Christ.
The tidal station's massive steel gate stretched for more than 100 feet above the generating plant set in the desert depression. When the facility was operating at full capacity, the gate could be lowered more than 30 feet to allow water to flow into large diameter pipes down into the long turbine room more than 100 feet below sea level. With the sun setting rapidly to the west, the gate had been closed and the turbines idled so crews could remove excess salt left over by the sun's evaporation, the key to the zero emissions facility. The missile off the Oregon hit the exposed machinery that operated the gate dead center, blowing apart the hydraulic systems and smashing the gears that acted as a mechanical brake. Even the pressure of the ocean it was designed to withstand couldn't keep the heavy door pinned in place, and it started to lower on its own accord into a recess built into the artificial dike. Water spilled over the top of the gate, first in thin, erratic sheets tossed by waves lapping against the structure, and then in a solid curtain when it fell below the surface. With less surface exposed to the titanic forces of holding back the Mediterranean, the gate accelerated downward. The curtain turned into a gush, and then into a torrent more powerful than the worst levee break on the Mississippi River. Millions of tons of seawater poured through the gap. The pipes to carry the water into the powerhouse were closed, saving the delicate turbines, so the deluge flowed wild and uncontained down the dike into the desert. Even when the plant wasn't active, there was a 2-mile exclusion zone around the facility for all shipping. It was a rule Max Hanley had gladly ignored. He'd been shepherding the Gulf of Sidra into the exact right position for when the missile hit. Up on the main view screen, he watched the ocean disappearing into the gap on the far side of the frigate, but more important, he could feel the pull of the current in the way his beloved ship responded to his controls. The Sidra had sheered away from the Oregon as soon as they were in the gravity-induced vortex, sucked toward the opening as surely as if she'd been aimed at it. Max goosed the directional thrusters and closed the gap, keeping one eye on the camera feed showing where Juan would appear.
Come on, buddy. We don't have all day.
The chairman suddenly burst through the frigate's hatchway, holding the hand of Secretary Catamora. Max steepened his angle and closed the gap, so the two ships brushed just enough to scrape a little paint off her hull. Juan was on the Sidra's railing at that exact moment. He lifted Fiona off the deck and hurled her onto the Oregon, where she fell into the waiting arms of a still woozy Mike Trono. As soon as Juan's boots hit the deck, Max pulled the big freighter away from the stricken frigate and opened the throttles as far as they would go. The warship was also desperately trying to get clear of the maelstrom. Smoke belched from her stack and her props beat the water frantically, and yet she lost more ground with every passing moment. The Oregon's revolutionary engines gave her 10 times the power, and once water was humming through the tubes, her lateral motion checked and she started to pull away. Max even eased back on the controls a touch, never wanting to push his babies harder than he had to. The Sidra's hull slammed into the open sluice intake at a perfect broadside. Water continued to rush under her keel, but half the floodwaters were suddenly contained once again. Balanced precariously, with the sea pressing in on the hull so her steel moaned at the strain, the crew could do nothing as the ship that had foiled their perfect plan steamed serenely away. On the Oregon's deck, the corporation operators who'd been blown back by the RPG clustered around the chairman and his guest. So little time had elapsed since that fateful moment that medical staff hadn't even arrived, but it looked as if Doc Huxley and her team weren't going to be busy after all. The injuries appeared minor. Juan stuck out a hand to formally introduce himself to Fiona.
I want to say it is an honor to meet you. My name's Cabrillo, Juan Cabrillo. Welcome aboard the Oregon.
She brushed aside his hand and hugged him tightly, repeating her thanks into his ear over and over again. The thing about adrenaline heightening one's senses was that it had that effect on all of them, so before Fiona realized how much Juan was enjoying the contact, he gently untangled himself from her willowy arms.
I know you're a woman of many accomplishments, but I wonder if acting is among them.
She looked at him askance.
Acting? After what we just went through, you're talking about acting. You call me nuts.
He slipped an arm around her waist to lead her into the ship's interior.
Don't worry. You get to play yourself, and we just practiced the scene I want to reproduce for Aligami.
You know?
I even know how he got leverage on Gaddafi. His grandson was in Switzerland on vacation when he was killed in a car crash. The crash was staged, and the boy kidnapped. If Gaddafi ever wanted to see the kid alive again, he had to make Ghami foreign minister, not knowing that he had just made one of the worst terrorists in the world a senior government official and given him access to everything he needed to pull off his little caper.
And you? Fiona asked.
How do you fit in with all of this?
He gave her a squeeze.
Just lucky, I guess.